both of us feel really passionate about international education as a game changer. And the earlier you start that, the more successful it can be.
If our institutions are going to thrive through our alumni's achievements and bring that back, we have to be prepared for that now. And internationalization is the first step toward successful global learning on any campus.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this World Strides podcast, Changing Lives Through Education Abroad, a weekly series of conversations with international education's most interesting thought leaders, as well as discussions on emerging trends, best practices, and innovation happening in our field. I'm your host, Seth McKettis, and we have a very special episode planned for our listeners today. I have been thinking about global learning programming for first-year students a lot lately, and I know it's been front of mind for many of our listeners as well. We know that first-year abroad programs benefit a university in so many ways. When done right, they advance recruitment, enrollment, and retention. But what are the benefits to students who participate in first-year programs? Today, we're going to dive deep into the learning outcomes of intentionally designed first-year programs, both at home and abroad. Global learning programming for first-year students promotes intercultural competency, advances language acquisition, strengthens a student's ability to negotiate complex systems, and a whole lot more. To help us unpack this topic, I am honored to be joined by two true international education luminaries who are experts in this topic. Jill Blondin is the Associate Vice Provost for Global Initiatives in Virginia Commonwealth University's Global Education Office. Jill was recently named the SIO of the Year by the Institute of International Education, an award she received at this year's AIEA conference in Washington, D.C. This is her second notable honor recently, as she was also named one of the Pi Insiders 50 Voices of North America for 2023. You might say Jill is having a moment. John Stoff is the Assistant Vice President for International Affairs at South Dakota State University. I have known John for many years, and I've always admired his commitment to his craft and to our field. In his current role at SDSU, John provides leadership in all areas of international education on campus, including international student and scholar services, education abroad, English as a second language, and international student recruitment. I like to think of John as an SIO's SIO. I can't wait to dive into this topic. You do not want to miss this episode, so stay tuned, dear listeners. Let's get into it. Jill Blondin and John Stoff, welcome to the show. Thank you both for being here. We've got a riveting conversation ahead of us today, and I can't wait to dive in. To start us off, though, I would like to give you both a chance to introduce yourselves and share briefly about your professional journey. Jill, let's start with you.
Thank you so much, Zach. I first and foremost and still identify as an art historian. My background is in art history. I come from faculty where I led study abroad, a faculty-led program to Italy, really was my entree into international education. Although art history by its very nature is global, as is pretty much everything, it was a real natural transition for me. I often say that I had no ambitions for administration, but unfortunately I was organized and people recognized that. Then I sort of made that transition into leading programs institutionally, and that's where I ended up. It's important to say that art history informs everything I do. I come from a liberal arts background where I was informed by math, history, geography, science. Everything goes into the way I approach things, and I naturally see the connections very broadly. And so that is a little bit about where I come from, but also the absolute belief that we have the ability through international education, through global learning opportunities, to change lives. That really informs the work that I do every day as well. That's me in a nutshell.
Thank you, Zach. It all begins really in my father's living room back in the late 1970s when a colleague of his at his college approached him as chair of the curriculum committee at his institution to establish study abroad at that particular college back then. It informed almost everything about my trajectory because my dad thought, well, you like stamp collecting, you like languages, and maybe this is something you should consider. And I did. Undergraduate days through graduate school really was informed by those moments as a middle school student my pursuit of history at the PhD level and my language acquisition over time, German, Spanish. I studied abroad in a variety of places and always had an eye open toward international education as a career field, certainly getting started as a faculty member in history at St. Ambrose University in Davenport, Iowa, way back when in the early 90s. I was focused on carrying a 4-4 teaching load, but at the same time, you have to do some committee work. And I thought, well, maybe I could do some in the study abroad committees. One thing led to another, as Jill describes. And I think the opportunity to think of the world out of my laboratory as a European historian, and at a small school, you teach more than your field at times, certainly as a world historian, it became a natural transition, and many graduate education and are now professionals in the field, and going to NAFSA and seeing a half dozen of my former students be active colleagues is certainly, I've seen the full circle. It's a wonderful field and I'm happy to be part of it.
Thank you both for sharing. The two of you collaborated on a book, Promoting Intercultural Agility and Leadership Development at Home and Abroad for First-Year Students. To say it adds new insights and value to our field is an understatement. In our conversation today, we will explore some of the ideas and case studies within the book, which is clearly a labor of love and professional passion. To get us started, I would like to ask you how it came about. What was the impetus of the work on this, and how did the two of you decide to undertake this endeavor? John?
As many good ideas, it started with someone telling me no and wanting me to prove them wrong. I worked for a time at a really wonderful institution called the College of New Jersey, where my office had a great synergy with faculty leaders and faculty members on campus. We had a wonderful first-year seminar requirement on that campus that was very liberal in the sense that you could do whatever you wanted to, subject area-wise, and teach a cohort of 18 first-year students who lived together and worked together on goals. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be great if we take some of the work taking place in education abroad? And this is going back 15 years almost to that endeavor. If we were to take students abroad during that time, and the president essentially said no, the only bad decision she made in 15 years there, perhaps. But it stayed with me. And coming to South Dakota State in 2019, they had a very nice first-year program for incoming freshmen, but they hadn't branded it, and it was basically go travel for 2 weeks. And I thought, well, maybe I can take that magic I had at TCNJ and bring it to South Dakota State. I was in the conversation to have a little bit of a transition in that programming. And then I met Jill. And Jill, of course, is an award-winning leader in international education, not just this year, but in previous years with the initiative they had at VCU called VCU Globe. As a leader in global learning, and she'll talk a little bit more about this, I'm sure, playing off ideas and trying to understand what type of changes we could make in our program to have an impact. We made a very successful transition to Jackstart Abroad at South Dakota State and had tremendous outcomes. That conversation continued that led to the book.
Congratulations on the book to the both of you. Dr. Blondin, each chapter of the book is a case study of successful first-year abroad programs. Could you share with our listeners how a book like this comes together and how you collaborate across the field in a way that makes for a cohesive resource?
Echoing what John said, the Jackstart Abroad program was a proof of concept for something that showed that you share information about that, you share information about the GLOBE program, which I had directed. There are pockets of this good work occurring all over the world. I want to be really clear and not having this because a variety of the chapters that we have in our book are case studies and work that's being done outside of the United States. I would not want to give anybody the impression that this is a book that's based entirely in the US because there's so much good work that's being done for the success of students worldwide. That John and I recognized we wanted to share these ideas with each other. We admired the work that each other was doing, and we knew that there were more people who were doing this work. Both of us feel really passionate about international education as a game changer. And the earlier you start that, the more successful it can be. Again, going back when we were telling our own stories and our own journeys, there's usually something that led you to that point or that inspired you to do good work. And so that for us, I feel really passionate about access and trying to get that to students as early as possible, to me guarantees a greater outcome for their success, whether that be in graduate school, in their careers. With that in mind, John and I knew that was happening. Oliver, you hear anecdotally and also from your colleagues and sharing. If we could put that all together in a single volume that focused on early intervention of international education, you bring that to an even greater audience. And the way that logistically we went about it, of course, first we found each other. In working together closely, we were able to sell the idea to a publisher who was very responsive to this, because really there hasn't been a lot of work that's been done in this space, both using our networks and the networks of those networks. We were able to really get the word out that we could draw in huge names in the field. Everybody who is published in this volume, to me, is a rock star. They've done so much good work. But when you have people who are as well known in this space as Hillary Landor, for instance, I'm giving her a shout out, when they want to be part of your project, someone who's already well known in the field, that you've hit upon something that's important. Logistically, for us, it was really getting out the work that we're doing. And the volume itself says that there is a lot of work that's being done worldwide. It's interesting. We're pulled in many different directions in any type of leadership, advising position we have, but we also want to access knowledge. If you can find that in a single place, be able to apply that at your own institution, pieces of it, then that's worth its weight in gold. John and I knew that because John and I wanted that book.
Thank you for sharing that insight with us, Jill. I completely agree that the list of contributors in this book is impressive, to say the least. Congratulations for bringing so many great people together. In the book's description, you note that it was, quote, designed with care for use by academic scholars in international education and is a much-needed resource in an area in which literature has not yet caught up with real-world academic programming. I really like this. And I also note that many practitioners who I'm in communication with have not yet had the chance to engage in educational programming specifically for first-year students. John, for our colleagues who are newer to this topic, what are some of the learning outcomes we hope for when we intentionally focus on sending first-year students abroad?
It really depends on where you are situating that program. If it's in a more generic first-year student base versus if you're preparing a cohort of students in your major field of study. Obviously, the model can be applied to just about anything we do, but we've identified about 5 core learning outcomes, no matter what subject area that you're looking to develop. And one, certainly developing self-responsibility in a variety of areas, being able to assess yourself and your strengths and weaknesses and moving forward to improve and enhance those types of strengths and weaknesses. In our campus, at least, talking about the development of strategies that will the student engage a wide variety of partners on campus and in the community and in the world at large to help them develop those skills and to prepare for careers and further education, developing an academic plan. And one of the other things about that is also thinking about, well, what else could I possibly do? Because what happens when linear algebra doesn't go your way, in my case? And thinking about, well, what if this isn't what I thought this was where I should be, and it's not, what do I do next? And developing that flexibility, the grit and resilience of making enough alternative course of action. We've talked about the development of personal goals and professional goals in these programs. And certainly, if you find yourself in Athens, Greece, as an 18-year-old, a freshman student, you got some time. You don't have to develop a goal right then and there. But having that experience, harvesting from that experience what can be useful in goal setting in the future and getting into a good habit of being ambitious. Understanding how the community at large, how the world has an impact on what people do in their personal lives, in their professional lives. These students are taking part in this program as representatives of their institutions. And it was an opportunity, or is an opportunity, for us to share what that institution brings to the world, what it's going to bring to the students, and be developing an identity with that institution and the people that you're traveling with. One of the biggest outcomes for us is that the students, when they come home from these experiences, are jackrabbits. They're South Dakota State people. And if you've ever been to South Dakota, there's not a heck of a lot of competition for identity. There are certain institutions that matter. And SDSU is one of them. And you could be born and raised and go through the system and wear blue and yellow your whole life. But this program really allows a student to adopt a personal interpretation of what does it mean to be a part of this entity. And I have no doubt that this is something that practitioners around the globe are finding as they are programming to this constituency on our campuses. And that's the biggest surprising takeaway I had. They love South Dakota more after leaving South Dakota.
Incredibly well put. A related note, while your book highlights case studies that differ in structure and goals, I wonder if we can find some commonalities. Jill, what are some of the hallmarks of a well-designed and purposeful first-year program abroad?
I would even expand that a little bit to talk about global learning programs on campus as well, because I will say that that really is also where my expertise lies, although I would put a little caveat or an enhancement to that question. But for me, there are two things that are ingredients in successful programs when you're dealing with first-year students and in also undergraduate students in general. It's really important. One is to have intentionality around what you're doing, to not expect that learning will take place, and to even do more than conduct it, but you really need to help lead. And part of that is going to be reflection. I'm not going to say reflection separately. I would probably wrap those two things up as intentionality and reflection is going to be part of that. And the second is to measure those out because you want to know what you did and you want to be able to assess it because otherwise you have planned a program that sounds good or it's echoing in your head that you did a good job because you've gotten some good feedback from students. I really think that you have to be very intentional. And that can look different ways, but the structure is going to play an important part of that. In the case, let's say, of the GLOBE program, we had coursework. We had a definition around the number of professional development opportunities and co-curriculars, students in which students would need to take part. We also designed those programs specifically to benefit them. The way we assessed it was both through external instruments, and I'm giving these as examples. I'm not prescribing, but things like the IDI, the GPI, an assessment tool that you could develop that is in concert with your own learning outcomes, because those are going to vary. You want perhaps an external instrument, but then there are other assessments that you can do too, writing reflections of the external instrument type assessments, or even writing samples and that sort of thing. You need to collect data. It doesn't have to be testing, but on the success of your initiative, however that's shaped. When people oftentimes enter into study abroad, or the way we try to get faculty interested, or the way we as faculty fantasize about what a study abroad program can be, often is little cherubs following me through Rome, thirsty for knowledge to learn about Santa Maria Sopra Minerva. That's in my head, and that's lovely. But what really is most important in terms of the learning is to structure that program so I can measure what they did, what content they've attained. And outside of the content, that's what's impactful about study abroad or a global learning program is it's not about content acquisition. It's also about soft skill set acquisition. How do you measure both of those? I've probably opened a huge can of worms and now nobody's going to want to lead a study abroad because there's too much about which to be intentional.
Yeah, I love what you said, Jill, about the importance of measuring our work. We need to be able to articulate it to those around us and those above us. We need to be able to make changes and measure what's working and what's not. I love that. And I know one of the topics you have written about and have dedicated professional time to is the concept of cultural agility. Could you unpack what that means for our listeners today and share how it intersects with leadership development?
It's interesting because when I first got involved in international education at my previous institution, people are always talking about intercultural competence. I understand there's been so much good work done in that area, but I always found myself really uncomfortable with that term. I still do. I don't like to say it because competence to me, when you say that, it implies that you've reached. I used to joke about the VCU GLOBE program, which I directed, because people would say, well, this is it, a global education living learning program focused on intercultural competence. I would say, led by a culturally incompetent director. And the reason I say that is because there's actually humility in that. which sometimes the competence piece doesn't quite get at. Whereas I feel as though when you talk about cultural agility, you're talking about nimbleness and you're talking about the need to be constantly changing and flexible and adaptable and open to all of the opportunities, learning opportunities that are there in front of you. I struggle with that. That's where I try to go with the cultural agility because it's a term with which I'm much more comfortable and allows for more success.
The book notes that successful first-year programs can, quote, sow the seeds of appreciation for global perspectives, propel enrollment in relevant coursework, and nurture the growth of culturally agile individuals poised to effect change in their future endeavors. Well, that certainly sounds like a worthwhile endeavor. John, for our colleagues who are listening and interested in this topic and would like to generate buy-in at their institution, could you speak more about propelling enrollment and how that can benefit both students and their home institution?
I'm going to piggyback on what we've been saying, our backgrounds as faculty members. And one of the first things I did in 1993 as a 27-year-old assistant professor is write an assessment plan and gather data from students who had come through our program in the 60s and 70s and where they ended up. And one of the things they noted was the importance of learning about the world. And some of them, having studied abroad, talked about those outcomes and the importance of global learning in their trajectories. And here we are, and traditionally we withhold that opportunity from students until they are sophomores or juniors and maybe even seniors and traditional junior year abroad types of constructs. To me, you have there's going to be a certain number of students who are applying to institution, taking a look at the international education component and seeing how it fits their goal set, even as 17 and 18 year olds. And the idea of walling off that experience until a certain date in the future is going to frustrate a certain number of students. And talking about opening up international education, global learning, both at home and abroad, to that first year student, you're going to allow that student who wants to know about the world dig into something right away that makes a difference and has meaning for them. That argument never ceases to amaze the admissions professional and the enrollment management administrator. And how do you then take that enthusiasm and design something that fits the institutional culture becomes part of the trajectory. Some of that was done for me before I arrived at South Dakota State. Certainly the idea of intercultural agility, although they do competence as a word here. I'm working on that. To be honest in saying that, you'd be surprised how many students benefit from this and are looking for this experience earlier on. The piece that we've discovered here is that there are parents and students of people, for example, who are out of state, international students who want to get to know some of these students in an intimate setting so that they start their experience as friends. They have a cohort of people. They have their people on campus. And as you look toward retention of students and you're taking students who might be a little shy or they might have a certain challenge and looking for a connection before they start their studies at the campus, some of the programming that we have in the book will provide highlights as to how the first-year experience in a global setting will make a positive impact on recruitment and persistence and retention of students throughout the lifespan. Those are places that folks are looking for a starting point. They might consider those talking points.
Thank you, John. Similar question, but this one's for Jill. Thinking from a 30,000-foot view, how have you seen first-year programming be pivotal in an institution's global learning goals for students?
Part of me wants to say what John said, because the idea of making students wait, thinking that there's some type of magic to having a student wait till their sophomore or junior year to engage in a global learning experience is a huge missed opportunity for the institution. Because if what we're trying to do is prepare students to live and work in the 21st century, to connect careers and professional development opportunities, to graduate out, to have great outcomes for them when they graduate, then we need to start this right away. To me, the institution's goals, and you see this more and more with workforce development initiatives and experiential learning, transformative learning, these are things that are discussed on campuses daily. Probably right now on my campus, that's all everyone's talking about. if global learning is a huge part of that, there is a direct alignment with all of those things, such as experiential learning, because that's what study abroad is, or that's what global learning or living learning programs, that sort of thing. Why can't we start that right away so that we can maximize those opportunities and maximize the preparedness of the students, which are directly related to those goals? I can't think of anything more important than allowing students to participate as early as possible. What that also does, that fulfills the institution's goals of preparing the students and promising to educate them. But what it also does is it creates, if a student studies abroad or is involved in some type of on-campus global learning program, they're probably going to be involved in other programs, and it's going to help retention. It doesn't help the institution's hope for job placement, but it also helps with retention and keeping those students and student persistence. And I see it as an international educator. I love to see what we always call repeat offenders. We're joking, of course, but students who have such a wonderful experience studying abroad early in their careers or engaging in some way, that they do it again and again and again. Among the most successful students I have had in my career are students who have studied abroad multiple times, full stop, in terms of the learning and opportunities that it creates for them beyond their undergraduate careers.
Hear, hear. They become frequent flyers, don't they?
Frequent flyers. Yeah. I say repeat offenders. I need to not come from such a deficit, but rather an asset mindset.
The book starts off by defining global learning, and it distinguishes it from the various forms of internationalization. I don't often hear folks really thoughtfully differentiating these terms. John, could you share some key takeaways from this distinction?
I'm old enough to remember internationalization being a controversial topic and not something that everyone did, but I think of internationalization as a prerequisite for global learning. Internationalization brings resources to the campus that allows global learning to flourish. And if I may, internationalization is sensitizing your institution for the need to have international partner universities, partner institutions, to support your faculty's development and becoming, you're talking about the network of networks, bringing people from your research area and bring that to a wider audience on campus if they have something to share. The flags that we have on our various buildings, and to have the flags of the world present at graduation ceremonies. And there are some superficial things that can be added to a campus and to the conversations on this campus that bring the international to the floor, and sensitizing our colleagues to the potential to go to an AACU workshop on global education and global learning. Seek those opportunities out within your disciplines. And that's providing the resources to enable colleagues to get that done. Jill has a masterful approach to it on her campus in having regular workshops with leaders in the field for the BCU faculty. And she can speak more to that, I'm sure, in one of her answers to your question. The global learning piece is central to the academic component of international education. And the reason why we're all here is to help educate students and prepare them for their lives. The idea that global learning can only take place in Heidelberg, Germany, or in Seoul, South Korea, is a misconception. Global learning takes place at home and abroad, and some of the entries and some of the chapters in our book talking about how do you bring these experiences to a wide variety of students at a minority-serving institution, at an HBCU, as well as international institutions outside of the United States. Global learning is essential if we're preparing students to be successful in this era. It's not a luxury. It's not an extracurricular add-on. Co-curricular programming needs to reflect the preparation of students to be international change agents, look at the outcomes of the value rubric for global learning in the AACU. We cannot not have our students take perspectives and be able to be global change agents. And if our institutions are going to thrive through our alumni's achievements and bring that back, we have to be prepared for that now. And internationalization is the first step toward successful global learning on any campus.
Very well articulated, my friend. Thank you for that. We here at World Strides are pleased to be able to support our partner universities to offer first-year abroad programs. We are being intentional about using a cohort model
working closely with partners to identify groups of students who would benefit from our new offering in Malaga, Spain. Jill, could you please share with our listeners some pro tips of how to talk to students and their families about the value of a high-impact practice like First Year Abroad?
I go back to actually a lot of what John said, which is we often say, and I heard this reiterated recently at the AIA conference in one of the plenary talks, about higher education is global education. We always say university is global, whether it likes it or not, how you're going to engage. Sending that message in a way that is student-focused is really, really important, that higher education is global education. Students, for it to talk about career opportunities, the way that we can connect those experiences with how it's not only going to enhance the rest of their college career, but also the way that it's going to help them with their career goals, whether, again, that's going to graduate school or that's entering the workforce immediately upon graduation, that there's data that shows that they're very good outcomes for students who participate in these type of programs. To speak to families, you go with the career when you're talking to students. Yes, students, that first-year students are interested in that, and they're interested in what they can do. What I used to always say to Globe students when they were thinking about joining, because it was a decision they made in their first year, what I would always say to them is, I can talk to you about all the great things that we're going to do together and all the growing and learning you're going to experience, but I'm also going to tell you about the 5 to 7 lines that this is going to immediately add to your resume. And how are you going to be different? What differentiates you from the other psychology majors, the other engineering business majors? You have to find a way to differentiate yourself. That's another way to talk to students. And another way for them too is, why did we all study abroad, or why did we all participate in this? There is a thirst for adventure and opportunity and fun. Sometimes in education abroad, we're caught up in trying to justify ourselves. It's like the liberal arts. Stop being defensive. It's fun.
Studying abroad is supposed to be fun. I completely agree.
It's supposed to be fun. It's also not mutually exclusive. It can be learning. It can be fun. And so sometimes as international education leaders and individuals, we play down the pure joy that is the reason so many of us went into this field and how joyous the learning was for us, healing to them with that passion and excitement that we feel, because it's one of those situations. I am always extraordinarily jealous of students who are embarking on going abroad for the first time, because I remember what that was like for me. Jealous in a good way. They are lucky. And I oftentimes will tell students too, the person that leaves the United States, is you're going to be a different person when you come back. I also think emphasizing the transformative in a positive way that's going to occur for those students, it's powerful, that we're really missing an opportunity when we talk to students and we try in the name of trying to justify it. Like John was saying, it's not a luxury, but sometimes we go too far the other way. It would be extraordinary to be in Malaga.
I can see why you win awards, my friend. That was very well articulated. Thank you for sharing that with us today. As educators, we know that studying abroad can lead to increased self-confidence, the ability to tolerate ambiguity, and enhance communication skills, not to mention the critical cross-cultural benefits that we've discussed before. Thinking through an academic lens, John, in what ways are you engaging in dialogue about these outcomes on your campus as you build the culture of global learning at South Dakota State University?
I remember my first meeting at South Dakota State University and talking about what was then an incoming freshman program and bringing in leaders from the different units, the 7 colleges, et cetera, into one place. And of course, the pandemic arrested that development for a while, but I could tell, having been an academic, that we had a lot of good intentions. We were enthusiastic and we had pom-poms for the idea shaking in the air, but we didn't have assessment data. And I know assessment is the A word in academia, but I cannot tell you how powerful assessment data can be in changing the minds of academic leaders and our colleagues and the faculty. And during the pandemic, we took the data that was sitting in files in our education abroad director's office and brought it to light. And I said, you need to put this forward because now we've got a story to tell, and making sure that we did that in nice graphics. But once we had the academic assessment data put forward and talking about the outcomes, we could then say, do you want your students to be participating in this and look at the impacts and blah, blah, blah. They were seeking us out rather than we seeking them out. And we gained some credibility. If you want to turn people on, assessment data is important and it will make an important contribution to any conversation.
Thank you, John. We know that impactful study abroad programs are bracketed by a strong pre-departure orientation and then scaffolded to process the learning and development that occurs on site. What are some of the ways that the pre-departure process looks different for first-year students versus students who have had more college experience?
Many times the students will have had no college experience. The pre-departure is going to have to involve both an entree into the college experience and into the study abroad experience, which are two separate things, but they're not going to trying to prepare students for the academic rigor and also functioning as an initial orientation to the institution, because they might not have, like I said, yet been on campus, demands a different approach. Now, that's also going to look different for cohort-based. Some situations, of course, where a student might be studying abroad in their first year on their own, but oftentimes these are cohort-based. Given the newness of the student to the academic experience, first-time students are moving away from home, they're going to have to be, during the orientation for the students, like I said, a very fully realized expectations of students, which can be uncomfortable. Because again, a few minutes ago, I was talking about how fun and joyful of an experience study abroad is. In order to ensure that, you're going to really want to set expectations. Also something that trying to foster self-awareness for students who are going on first year experiences, have probably never traveled before without their families, and also self-awareness in terms of how the group might be perceived, how the students might be perceived. And of course, too, it's really incumbent on the people who are leading the orientation, the directors, to also talk about subjects around sexual orientation, race, things that could be potentially uncomfortable. And students having not yet been on campus may not have had those conversations, showing and demonstrating a lot of sensitivity, but understanding around these type of issues, like I said, about which they might not have had discussions. I can't emphasize the importance enough of talking about those subjects with students for their safety, their awareness, and for empathy, to be empathetic for access purposes and understanding and belongingness.
Thank you, Jill. And I want to give you both the chance to let our listeners know where they can find this book. John, for listeners who want to dive into this more, where can they find the book?
It is available electronically at the igi-global.com site. Probably the quickest way to get to the book is to email Jill or me, and we could certainly get you the link that you would need. The book is available electronically today and at a 50% off discount. If you play your cards right, the book will be available in print later in the spring. I encourage you, igi-global.com is the publisher, and they are very well attuned to marketing. You'll be seeing more about this book over the next couple of months, I'm sure.
Terrific. Well, thank you both. I have one more question that I'd like to ask the both of you. And we'll start with you, Jill. As you think about education abroad in 2024, what makes you hopeful?
Everything. I would say my first response is everything. We see numbers growing for study abroad post-COVID. We've been able to also begin to see some more diversification of locations for study abroad, which is important as well. And I see a lot of institutions supporting students in terms of Gilman applications, thinking about, I'll give one example. And as part of that, we have our Black and Abroad initiative, which we've really tried to use as a way of encouraging students to study abroad through peer voices. We're seeing the payoff from initiatives that show people they belong anywhere. I feel very hopeful. I can't think of anything more important than increasing cultural understanding through study abroad for students. It's something that I did, that I do in my professional life. I've devoted my life to it, and that my own children have done. I feel hopeful about the future because of the students participating.
Thank you, Jill.
I affirm everything Jill said. And in my most immediate realm here in South Dakota State, we have been working very carefully and intentionally with the Native American populations in our region, particularly our state, in developing the capacity to participate in and to offer opportunities in education abroad for these students. And it is an uphill battle. It is not easy. The students do not make it past the finish line to graduation in the same rate as others, and there are lots of obstacles. However, we have had a number of success stories in developing programming, and this comes from an AIEA session several years ago in New Orleans about how do you develop that programming for Native students? How do you get their attention? How can you get them to consider? And we're making baby steps toward this, but the willingness of people to participate in the journey and in the conversation, I see that initiative in other places. The book's contents in particular should give a great deal of hope for people in bringing new voices to education abroad amongst our faculty and administrators, and most importantly, our students. And Rome was not built in a day, as Jill can tell you from a professional standpoint, certainly in our practical world of study abroad. Keep at it. Good things are happening. Students are being affected positively. And let's go to the next thing on our schedules.
I can't imagine a better place to end things than right here. Dr. Jill Blondin and Dr. John Stoff, this has been such an inspiring and enlightening conversation. Thank you both for being here. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode of Changing Lives Through Education Abroad. I'm your host, Zach McInnes, and please make sure to join us next week as we continue to explore topics on international education and exchange. Thank you to my spectacular World Strides colleagues, Lindsay Kelchner and Sarah Kachuba, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Please subscribe to Changing Lives Through Education Abroad on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And share with your friends and colleagues. Let's create life-changing moments together.